Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding. How to ask for music rights. And what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi and welcome to the Art of Film Funding. Our guest today is Dr. Fred Alan Wolfe. He's the author of many books, including Taking the Quantum Leap, Parallel Universes, The Dreaming Universe, The Eagle's Quest, The Spiritual Universe, Mind into Matter, Matter into Feeling, many books, also including The Yoga of Time Travel, How the Mind Can Defeat Time, and his latest book, Dr. Quantum Presents, A Little Book of Big Ideas. And Carol, you often quote from Dr. Fred Alan Wolfe's book, The Dreaming Universe, and I know you have been a big fan of his work for years.
I am, Claire, and it's exciting to have Dr. Wolfe so available to filmmakers. Dr. Wolfe, we are a great fan of yours, and we thank you for coming to share your vision.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be on your show.
Well, your brilliant book, The Dreaming Universe, is a favorite of mine because I want to start with the quote that you let me use years ago on daydreaming. Because I was a big daydreamer in school, I was often watching the wildebeest migrate on the Great Serengeti, or I was skiing under the Matterhorn, and I can honestly say that many of those things actually happened for me. So when I read in your book and found where it said that sometimes when you're daydreaming, it was as if a handshake across time occurred, and often the event you daydream would actually happen. Well, I know this to be true for me, so could you talk about this?
You know, this is very funny. I don't remember ever writing anything about handshaking across time when describing daydreaming in my book, The Dreaming Universe. However, I have used that concept of a handshake across time between, say, the future and the present in a conceptual framework which was invented by a physicist named John Kramer. It is called the transactional interpretation. It has to do with how the future and the present have what is called a handshaking transaction. We can daydream and think of anything happening in the future, but which one is likely to happen? Well, it's that future which is, in a sense, the more probable one that's going to reach across time to the present and present itself as literally a handshake. And so this concept is in my other books. In other words, we do have a definite thing in physics, I don't know what you might call it, in which the future as well as the present affects what we normally call our experience of now.
The future as well as the present represents the now, can be the now, right?
Affects the now. In other words, now is not just a consequence of the past. It's also a consequence of the future. In other words, what you hope to happen or what you visualize as happening, as well as what has happened to you, affects the actions you take now.
All right. That's brilliant. So, well, I teach intentional filmmaking, and one of the most important things I tell the filmmakers is to give them 15 minutes a day to daydream, especially about their film. And I recommend that they see it finished, to pretend they're in a packed screening room watching the film, and to feel the joy of completion, because I think it's important to pretend that it's successfully finished and keep moving towards that aim, that goal. And so that would rather fit with what you're saying, right?
Well, it would in a way, but, you know, it isn't the way I actually work when I'm in my most creative moments. I prefer to be surprised. I'm a writer who doesn't want to know what's going to happen next. I would like to have whatever I've created surprise me and say, oh, wow, I didn't see that coming. And the surprisals, to me, lend the most ground, or it will give me the most base upon which I can have a creative moment. In other words, I feel more creative when I don't know what's going to happen rather than when I do. Somehow, having the whole thing done in your mind means, to have the memory of the whole thing done in your mind makes it a little less exciting for me. And maybe that's why we don't know the future very well, because I think if human beings were to totally operate in such a way that they could see everything, the past, the present, and the future, as things happening to them, they would feel maybe a little robotic.
Well, that's true. I think that I've heard other writers say that they start off without knowing where they're going and that they have a better outcome that way. So I understand that. For filmmakers, their biggest challenge is getting the money. And that's where I think they need to be be focusing on the fact that their film is a strong potential, that their vision is solid, and that they can see it completed and move towards that.
Maybe so. I don't know if you know this, but in my past, I actually was an amateur filmmaker. I mean, it sounds rather strange
that.
For physicists, but I've worn many hats. I've also been a professional magician. I performed close-up magic at the Magic Castle in Los Angeles. I've also been a harmonica player, classical harmonica. I've also filmed my journey around the world. And with my physics for college class when I was teaching at San Diego State, I made a movie. And we'll talk about that a little later on in the program.
Okay, wonderful. Well, what I'm interested in is I listened to your Dr. Quantum tapes, and I really love them. And I was wondering about this quantum term, collapsing the wave. And a lot of people are saying that this is a concept that every moment there are many possibilities available to each of us. And when you choose one and set an intention to achieve it, then you're turning that possibility into a strong potential. And how do you feel about that?
Well, it's one of my concepts that I basically invented. I call it popping the quiff. The quiff is like a big balloon of possibilities, and when you stick a pin in it, you pop it, and that makes something actually happen. So I think the concept of collapsing the wave is indeed a very useful metaphor. And, of course, it arose from quantum physics. In quantum physics, we have a problem, and that is how do the various possibilities that can occur once things interact or relate with each other, how do they change into something that actually takes place? When quantum physics was first discovered, possibilities were viewed as something like waves of information that have all the possibilities traveling through space. And then the problem was how a wave of all possibilities can suddenly change into a specific spike appearance of an actual event. It's like a wave rushing on the shore, and it's hitting all the various places on the shore it could, and suddenly at a moment when an observer comes in and makes an observation, the wave suddenly collapses to just a splash at one point. The spike of possibility would then be something that only showed up at one particular place, namely the place where the observation occurred. Well, lately quantum physics has become a little more sophisticated and a little more abstract, and it's expanded our understanding of processes that we now are able to witness. So it may not necessarily be just a thinking of it as a wave that moves through space that we normally think of, but we may think of it as wave which moves into a space of ideas. In other words, as if your ideas were laid out in space. Idea one, idea two, idea three, they're all laid out. And this wave is moving through all these ideas. And suddenly, one of the ideas pops into existence. In quantum physics today, we're playing with a concept called quantum computers. And these quantum computers work with concepts which are simply numbers, zero and one, on and off. And if that's all we had was zeros and ones, they would be what we call bits. But quantum zeros and ones are called qubits. They are things which could be zero or one or something in between, which has some magical interference properties which allow dreams, or you might say possibilities, to cohere to produce something rather than something else.
Wow. That's wonderful. So it's no longer one or oh, it's there's something in between.
That's it. And the in-betweenness is extremely important. But what's interesting about it is that when an observation occurs, whatever takes place will be either a zero or a one.
When it takes place. But in the interim, when it's still forming, you have an option.
When it's still forming, it's neither zero or one. It's everything in between.
Wow. Well, let's go back to this where the wave moves through all these ideas, and a lot of ideas come up. I like that because I have sometimes had a question for to solve. Let's say something I wanted to do, and I had one or two possibilities, and I would just give it to the universe and say, I've got to find a better way, or is this the best way? And then the next day I might get a third idea that was better than the other two. So maybe is that still part of what you're talking about?
Yes, definitely. That's the way we experience it, just like you said.
Wow. Okay. All right. So, and you call that the quantum computer.
The way quantum computers operate is they use inputs, or you might say the things which are given to the, when you use a computer, you sit at a keyboard and you type in text or whatever, and then the computer performs a set of actions which then results in an output, which might be words on a screen or even the editing of a film. Various things can happen that is the output as a result of what you input. With a quantum computer, what you input is not just a particular set of inputs, but an input which has all the possibilities which might result. And what comes out is any of the possibilities which the quantum computation can result in. And that's what makes quantum computers interesting, is that they have a surprise effect in them. There's more I can say about that, but that would take up the whole show.
Right. Well, in your set of CDs from Sounds True, Dr. Quantum, A User's Guide to the Universe, on the cover you state the very act of observing events in your life can alter their outcome. So is that part of this or an extension of this?
Yes, it is, very much so. Quantum physics is basically, it's the same story, only with added chapters, you might say, or more character development as we go along. Yes, the whole idea was if suddenly a wave of possibilities can change into a specific spike of reality, how did that take place? And the only thing we know for sure was that somehow we were observers, and we, as observers, gained knowledge about what it was that we were observing. So apparently observation seems to be affecting reality. If by reality we mean our understanding of reality as we understand it through quantum physics.
Wonderful. All right. The Dr. Quantum CDs also talk about the quantum leap, the moment when we transform potential into reality. So can we talk about that for a minute?
Well, that's, in a sense, we may have covered some of it, but it's indeed, it's when an event, like the thing I call the spike, takes place. That is, we suddenly observe something we know, and we say that a quantum leap has occurred. That's really what a quantum leap is. It's a sudden jump from what is to what could be without anything going on in between.
Excellent. Okay, so this is like magic. No wonder you're a magician as a fun thing to do, because it seems to work with the quantum physics. It must give you an expanded mindset to be able to absorb all of these concepts.
Well, it's helped me write, because it's a subject I enjoy writing about.
Well, most of our listeners are creatives. They're filmmakers, writers, musicians, producers, directors, and so forth. So can you give them any advice on how to enhance their creativity?
Yes, I can. It's pretty simple, actually. The most, and I mean most important thing is to have desire to have something emerge from your creative consciousness, to want it. Without that desire, nothing really can foment and take place. Just like you were talking about before, you had two ideas and you had the desire, and the next day a third idea popped into place. The most important thing that was going for you is, I want this. Then, and this is important, have faith that you are able to make a discovery that will be something useful for your film or project, whatever it is. Now, as a project for a class I taught many years ago called Physics for Poets, As I mentioned earlier, I made a movie about what might be silly to think about today, and that was, how does a God create a universe of people around him where all these people around him carry out what appears to be his will, but they appear to themselves as having their own wills? That was my movie, and I actually made this movie. You can actually download it from YouTube. The entourage of people, of God, this God, and the people that I were, the work I was doing, I was working with my class for Physics for Poets, and I took them out to a nude beach in California, in La Jolla, California, called Black's Beach, very famous, well known, where you can swim nude. I'm not sure if you can still do it today, but then you could. Anyway, God then tried to do something never done before, and he suddenly vanishes from the view of all the people, who in turn vanish since they were God's dream in the first place, a kind of self-annihilation process. But God is internal, so he pops up again, like popping out of the ocean, like what I talked about before, the quantum wave just pops. But he has no dream. He has forgotten. He's desolate. He seeks to dream again and to find himself. So what does he do? He does what most of us do. He descends into hell. And there he finds the devil. And the devil tries to change God into a servant of evil. Dog God, anagram. He wants to make him into a dog of evil. But God refuses and emerges from hell and then finds himself back to now, a now lonely beach that he started from. And then, being horny, he dreams up a beautiful woman, and an erection appears, and he suddenly realizes how to create the whole universe all over again. Well, maybe this was a too male-orientated concept. We then find out that all of this story is naturally also just a dream of somebody feeling and seeking inspiration, who's walking on the beach wondering about his own creativity. And the movie ends. Ta-da!
Oh. Great film. Sounds wonderful.
Done in about 20 minutes.
Oh.
And it's done with no dialogue, just music of the times. This was made in the 70s. So it's the music of the times in the background. You might enjoy reading it. Enjoy actually watching it.
I will, definitely. All right. So I know that some people say that writers go into what they call the quantum field or someplace where they bring back information, rather like the shaman who go to the other side and bring information or healings back for the tribe. What do you think of this?
Well, you can think of this as a new metaphor. You can think of it metaphorically as going into a quantum field and reaping some wheat, just like you would walk into a wheat field and reap some wheat, and then carrying it back, and then putting it into bread or whatever, but it is just a metaphor. It really may be not very useful, but it may be something that people would like to think about in terms of that picture. In the latest theory today, which unites quantum physics and Einstein's general theory of relativity, the entire universe is now seen as a, this is going to sound maybe even stranger, as a two-dimensional painting on a cosmological horizon as if it were a hologram. You know, a hologram is a two-dimensional thing in which you shine light through it and you get a three-dimensional picture coming out. And the same idea called a holographic principle indicates that the information that we see in our everyday world is somehow projected from this two-dimensional surface. And where is the surface located? Surface is located at the beginning and the ending of time. This sounds poetic, but it's what physicists think about these days. It's pretty crazy. And the idea was inspired by what is called a study of black holes. And the idea was that somehow when things fall into a black hole, they seemingly never come out. And this was a little bit of a worry for quantum physics because quantum physics has something about conservation of information. It may be that the information is scattered into many different possibilities, but when you add them all up again, you should get back the total. If a black hole gobbles up the information, then when you add up what's left back again, you've lost some of the information. So the question is, what happened to that information? Where did it go? And so the insight was that the information was somehow stuck on the surfaces of the black holes, and the black hole didn't really gobble them up. The information was still there. And so those people then began dreaming, well, if it can happen to a black hole, why not? Can it happen here in ordinary space? So according to this idea, the three-dimensional world, the world that we normally live in, emerges out of the information that is printed on these on this two-dimensional surface. And in fact, you can not only have the information printed on surfaces at the beginning of time and the ending of time, you can have information printed on surfaces 1 second ago and 1 second in the future. In other words, there could be these things we call light sheets, which are two-dimensional surfaces in which all the information which is needed to make an apple fall in a room is contained on these sheets. And what we call the apple falling in a room is nothing but a projection from these two sheets into a space which itself is a projection. This is all very weird. It indicates that maybe what we're dealing with is movies galore. There's only two-dimensional surfaces, and everything we see or imagine happening out there is just an illusion. And so this is maybe difficult to visualize, but we can visualize these sheets as like the flash of a camera, and the camera flashes and light expands until it reaches walls forming a sheet, and or equivalently you can think of the light moving backward in time from the walls to the camera. The light reflects off the walls and contracts back to a point. The information is encoded on these sheets, and it describes everything happening in the room at the instant the light bounces off the walls. Now, this all sounds pretty crazy, but you writers and you filmmakers and you television show creators were way ahead of us on this one. There was a TV show once that was very popular. I enjoyed it even more than the original. It was called Star Trek: The Next Generation. The original Star Trek was great, But I think the best series made was The Next Generation. And it was an episode that was entitled Ship in a Bottle. And what happens is the crew of the Enterprise, the name of the ship, are confounded by the appearance of an entity, Dr. Moriarty, or Dr. M, I'll call him, who is generated literally off the walls of the ship's holodeck. Now, a holodeck is a special room within the ship where people who want to get away from the pretty tedious environment of being inside of a ship can escape into a three-dimensional holographic world, which appears to them to be very real. They can reach out and touch it. It's like virtual reality that we presently know about galore, which you not only can see it as three-dimensional, but you can touch it. You can talk to it. It'll talk back to you. Of course, having machines talk back to us is nothing new. We've got those right now. But this is all at the highest technology available in the 25th century or something like that. So these people can just walk into this room and have experiences. And so Dr. M was generated, and he's in this holodeck, and the members of the crew are talking to him, and he says to them, these are a couple of members of the crew who came into the holodeck, and Dr. M suddenly appears and starts explaining that somehow, he says, he has become self-conscious. And since he knows, I think, therefore I am, he says, I want to live in the real, quote-unquote, real world. And he says to the captain that since he can think, I think, therefore I am, I must be able to exist. The captain warns him. He says, no. No holo-generated image can exist outside of the holodeck. But Dr. M insists, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, I think, therefore I am, and commands the holodeck doors to open. Whereupon they do, and whereby he next simply walks out through the doors into the ship's interior, leaving the holodeck, much to the amazement of the ship's crew. And they said, that's impossible. They were standing around looking at each other, and it makes no sense. So they decide to follow him to see where he goes. And eventually, they discover something which wasn't apparent to them as they were following Dr. M. What they find out is that everything, including the doors of the holodeck opening and the interior of the ship through which Dr. M goes and where they follow, all of that has been encoded in the holodeck itself. The holodeck encompassed images of a virtual holodeck and a virtual ship, and a virtual crew. Only the original crew members that came into the original holodeck are real. All the other crew members are virtual. And the virtual Dr. M and the real crew, they never really left the holodeck. However, Dr. M insists on continuance as a real being because he has this concept that he's self-aware, which may be a computer program, we don't know. So the captain, Captain Picard, says, okay, well, what we'll do then is I'm going to help you. We're going to, he talks to his engineer and he says, let's create an image of the whole universe for Dr. M, and we'll set him up in a cyberspace in a little cube so that Dr. M can move about in his cyberspace whole universe while still confined in the holodeck's library. Dr. M has no way of knowing this, and as the episode ends, we see Dr. M and his girlfriend escaping into the universe from the ship, not realizing that all of that has been taking place inside of the holodeck's cube inside of the library. And the real crew then look at themselves, and they begin to wonder, wait a minute, are we just images inside of some unimaginable technology? And of course, as I watch the show, I realize that they are inside of my box, the television receiver I am watching.
Right. Oh, my gosh. And are you inside of a box somewhere?
That's it. That be- question we all have to ask ourselves. And as I said, the modern physical holographic principle indicates we are, that all of us think of ourselves as individualized beings separate from everybody else, but we ain't. We're all projections from some maybe universal mind. And maybe the greatest creativity comes about when you begin to, in a quiet place, realize that without going crazy in the realization.
Maybe the great creativity comes about when you realize that, where you are. Can you expand on that a minute? That's good.
Well, it's something that I began to suspect. I couldn't prove it, but I began to suspect a long time ago. I have insights. And so this notion is important to me. And as a result, I am totally comfortable being alone and writing or whatever I do, or with people. I have no, you know, some people just find it very hard to just be by themselves. They have to do something to drown out this loneliness that they experience. And so I have learned that, or by this understanding, I have no problem being by myself. And is that answer your question? I'm not sure what the question was again.
Well, this is a good answer, but it allows you. Do you feel when you are alone, can you tap into your creativity and your oneness with the universe on a more continuous basis?
Yes, I can.
How do you handle all this knowledge and still function? Do you use the knowledge to function with?
No. I just trust that it's there. It's all the things I need are in my library, which is the hologram at plus and minus infinity of time. And I just simply, when I need something, I just think it and it appears. It doesn't come right away. I have to sometimes work at it, but nevertheless, the way that I make things appear is I have this, it's to make something appear, desire it. That's all there is to it. It doesn't mean it's going to happen right away, but your desire is equivalent to you walking into a library and looking on the shelf and screening or scanning all the titles to find something which interests you. If you don't have that desire, you haven't entered the library.
Right. That's brilliant. So when you're writing and you get an idea and you want to know more about that subject, then you you really are drawing it to you. Somehow it appears or you find the information.
It's already there. It's already there. I don't have to, I mean, I'm a projection from it, so to speak. So it's already
there.
I'm already there. It's not like I have to go all the way to the beginning and ending of time because I'm already at the beginning and ending of time. I don't know how to explain that to you, but I'm already there. So it's just my desire puts me in the library. Without the desire, I'm not in the library. And
right.
Once you decide that you don't want to look, nothing will come to you. This is the notion that the universe gives you what you want. Well, it's actually, you're the universe giving yourself what you want. You want it or you don't want it. If you don't want it, you ain't going to get it. That's all there is to it. Sometimes you get things you said you don't want, like maybe a bad accent or something like that. Well, it's a probabilistic universe. Nothing is perfect. It's not a machine. It's not like, you know, we have Google search engines, which you type in a few words and suddenly everything that could possibly appear under that title will show up. It's more like that. It's not like I type in a certain, you know, that only one title shows up or only one thing happens. Sometimes good things show up and sometimes bad things show up.
Right. Well,
same thing
I know
with making a movie. Sometimes you make a movie and you think it's great and it stinks. and you can't see it. So, I mean, it happens. It happens to everybody. You write a book and you think it's a great book and nobody wants to buy it. I was watching a television series recently called The Asset about the spy Aldrich Ames back in the 70s and or the 80s, whenever it was that he was caught. Great series. They showed two episodes at ABC. They said, nobody's watching this. Pull it off the shelves. And it's gone. And this is a series which it's at 10 o'clock at night on a Thursday evening. And who's going to be watching it at that time? Well, it takes a while to build up an audience. I mean, people don't just suddenly find it and start watching it. They their friends tell them about them. It takes a little while. And after a while, if it's a good series, it'll catch on. When Breaking Bad first aired out, people weren't watching it either. But producers or the television station, I believe that was I can't think of the name,
Showtime.
Network. What?
Showtime?
No. Breaking Bad was not shown on Showtime. It was shown on one of the cable networks. I just can't remember which one it was. I think it was the movie network, A something M or whatever. And when it first started showing up, people weren't watching it, but the network had faith that there would be an audience for it because it was well written, and it became it garnered an award after six or seven seasons, like 7 years of being shown, as being, if not the best, one of the best series ever produced on television, and so this is a thing that happens. What is something good for one person's point of view may be terrible for another.
Right. And so you, yes, you're so right. Well, let me go on to some more questions because you write such good books and you have a big array of books, so you must have some kind of formal setup in your life that you write every day and you focus on your books. So can you tell us any ideas on how we can use, any ideas that we can use to use our creativity? Because obviously you've got this structured in your life.
Well, this is most important. You've got to take time to be alone and with your desire and and start writing. It doesn't matter what you start writing. Just start taking some action and allow things to develop. Allow the process to start to occur. But you got to be alone. People do group creativity ideas and so forth, and that may be great, but I would suggest that before you group to make something appear, that you each come in with some set of ideas or principles or concepts that you develop, and then get together to talk about it. Don't just come in with a blank slate. That usually doesn't work. You've got to have some agenda in your mind as to what you want to see on the screen. So that's, to me, important alone time. I'll just call it enhance alone time before you get together with others.
Enhanced alone time. Well done. And then do you set a structure your day so that at certain hours you devote to writing or thinking
about?
It
varies. It depends on what it sort of depends on what I'm working on. When I'm working on a book that I've already got flowing, and it's just a matter of the next day I'm going to continue where I left off, I usually do that on a regular ritual of the mornings. When I'm playing around with different processes, I can start working on them anytime. There's no particular time. Very often now I find myself working late at night. I don't know why. I just I may watch television for an hour or two during the evening or even longer. And then maybe 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, I may sit down on my computer and suddenly ideas start to come. So it depends. It all depends on whether I've started a string and I'm continuing to knit, so to speak. I've started a sweater, and I'm continuing to knit right along, or whether I'm trying to figure out what yarn I'm going to use. Literally, what yarn am I going to tell?
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. Well, can you share with us anything you're working on now?
Well, there were a couple things that I thought I'd mention before we got to that question, which is something to do with how we gain information. I just wanted to give this particular point that to connect to the universe. This is an added thought. To connect to the universe and to find where information is. As I said, you have to be confident, you have to be desirous, and then, most important, take action, write it, paint it, make the movie, carry out the action. Don't just talk the talk, walk the talk. One of the most important things that we're beginning to realize along this line is Marshall McLuhan once said a long time ago, the medium isn't just the medium for carrying the message. The medium is the message. This means that the form of the medium is itself the message, or if you will, the medium is also the massage. It's that which affects us. It touches us. Thus, we enter in this quantum age where the symbiotic and reciprocal relationship which ensues by which the medium influences how the message is perceived, and the perception of the message in itself, in turn, influences how we make it. So it's a circle of stuff. The medium influences how we're going to write our message, and once the message is perceived, that influences how we're going to make the media itself. So McLuhan was saying that medium itself, not the content it carries, should be the focus of our creativity. And of course we see that every day in, for example, computer generated action films, which are okay if they use sparingly, but a film just with computer generated action is something I don't particularly like, but sometimes I think it's overdone. But anyway, it's clearly showing how the society plays a role in what's delivered to the society. In other words, they, by what they find interesting, change the medium that's being delivered to them. So this is, I think, an important part. Now, what am I working on now, or what am I interested in at the moment? As I said before, I'm in a kind of quiet research mode where ideas pop in at various times of the day, and I'm writing and figuring out what it is that makes our conscious acts take place. How does that spiky pop occur? And I'm beginning to think it has something to do with information coming from the future and from the past, something forming what is called a closed time-like curve. This is a curve in space and time in which once you are moving on that curve, you can think of the curve as like a huge tube. Once you're moving in that tube, if you were to watch your own watch on that tube, it would be constantly going forward in time, but you could curve around, curl around, and then come out of the tube, not in the future, even though you would be the future for yourself, but you would actually be in the past for the rest of space-time. In other words, you could travel in time. And I think that something like this is going on inside of our brains, inside of the way observation takes place, and this is something I'm playing with.
That's incredible. So what you're saying is that you're dealing with information from the future and the past.
Exactly.
And this is a closed time-like curve.
That's right. That's right, a closed time-like curve.
And space
and
time.
We call them CTCs.
Wow. So can you tell us some more? Can you explain this a little further?
Well, it's a development which started out when people were attempting to understand Einstein's relativity theory. And when they first formulated the theory was predicting solutions to the equations of general relativity, which had these closed time-like curve possibilities in them. And at that time, people just said, well, that's impossible. It's just a quirk of the theory. It can't be that important. It must be something basically wrong with it, but the basic idea must be correct. We'll just kind of ignore it. We'll sweep it under the rug, so to speak. And this went on for a while, and then some people began to inquire a little bit more deeply into what that meant, and that eventually led to something called black holes, which involves space-time or solutions to the Einstein equations in which you get these loops, these closed time-like curves. So people began to take them even more seriously. The big problem has been, and continues to be, how do we merge this general theory of relativity, which now has these weird closed time-like curves in it, with quantum physics, which also has this kind of weird action coming from the past into the present and action coming from the future into the present. So it also has a kind of, not a closed time-like curve, but the possibility of the future influencing the present in it. So people began to wonder, maybe there's some way to merge, maybe the merger comes in through those two conceptual frameworks, and that's what people have been working on. And in the early 1990s, I hate to admit that's 20 years ago, a physicist at Oxford University began to wonder, well, how would a quantum computer operate if it was allowed access to a closed time-like curve? The idea would be, well, it must be something, that paradoxical about that. You can't go back in time and murder your own grandfather, for example. But it turned out you could. And what he discovered was not only could you do that, but when you did that, the universe that you emerge into is not a universe in which you were ever born in the first place. So what you do is universe hop. You jump from one universe to another if you do something like take that kind of action. So there was a consistency as long as there were what is called a multiverse. In other words, it was not just one universe, but an infinite number of parallel universes in which by entering these closed time-like curves, you could travel from one universe to another and go on and traveling on in infinity. This might be a great film to have a time traveler who gets stuck on a closed time-like curve and keeps jumping between universes. We've already had a TV program called Quantum Leap, which had our hero jumping into time, into various past situations in which he emerges essentially in the brain of another individual. When he looks at himself in the mirror, he doesn't see himself as he really is, but as who the person is in that particular time zone. This would be maybe like almost an extension of that idea, but many more possibilities because of all the possibilities for paradoxes that can arise and how he gets out of them. Anyway, that's the way it is.
That is an incredible concept. And can you just say what this would mean to us in our daily lives? Any way, let's say that you find that when these two things do merge together and they are a functioning part of each other, what would that mean?
Well, I think what will emerge from that is maybe a full realization, and this may sound even stranger, of the sacred aspect of our consciousness. There's still a mystery in all of this, even though we may get all the structure of relativity and quantum physics figured out. But the mystery is, well, what about my consciousness? Where does that come in? And I think that because I think the closed time-like curves may have something to do with how something which is probable becomes actual, how that emerges, we may find some new insights into the nature of consciousness. And this may be what might be a discovery of our relationship with God, or with a relationship with the mind of God, or however you want to think about it.
Because from what I've heard, even Amit Goswami is saying consciousness came first and then everything followed. So that would mean that with our consciousness, we are creating throughout this whole thing, aren't we?
Yeah. Yes, basically, that's right.
I hope so. Oh, I love this. So this might be something that you write about in the future or talk about.
Well, I do, and I have, and I probably will, and maybe a book will emerge out of it. I don't know. As I say, things are cooking right now, and I haven't quite got the whole thing in mind yet. Usually what happens with me is a title will emerge first, and then from the title, I begin to branch off into various possible directions in which that title will take me.
Do you have a title for this?
Well, I do. It's called The Gravity of the Situation.
That's a good one.
And basically, because gravity is part of general relativity, it's how gravity is actually related to not only time, but also to consciousness and mind.
That is really something to look forward to. Well, thank you so much. Tell us, how can people find your books and your CDs and more about you?
Well, believe it or not, it's pretty easy. If you just type in my name and Google Fred Alan Wolf, there are thousands of websites in which you can find me. And the first few things which pop up on Google will most likely be my webpage. It's fredallenwolf.com. It's pretty easy. On my webpage, there's listings of all the things I've written, and comments and questions and answers and things you can download for free, and all kinds of things you can play with. So I would say just do that. I've also, you can also find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. I have a blog. I don't keep up with these things right now. I'm not very good at social media, so I'm not spending much time doing social media. But other people are, so maybe people, when you go to my social media website, you can find more information about me that even I don't even know about.
Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much for the information. We really appreciate your time, and I know I speak for so many filmmakers that you've given us some wonderful concepts to play with and imagine, and things that we can listen to this several times to get it all.
Yeah,
a lot
so,
in here,
yes.
Dr. Wolf.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and also I'll just remind our listeners, too, that if Dr. Wolf does have a Twitter page, he also has a Facebook page. So, yes, you'll find those things online. And, again, Dr. Wolf, thank you so much. Perhaps when you have your new book that you're working on come out, we'll have you back on the show.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Be well, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.